97.9 FM, WCHL, and the UNC College of Journalism and Mass Communication presents Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus is dedicated to in-depth examinations of issues of overarching importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions to problems in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the UNC campus, here's your host, journalism professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, the possible unionization of college athletes. Our guest, Jeffrey Michael Hirsch, a professor at the UNC School of Law, who specializes in labor law and union organizing. Last week, a regional director of the National Labor Relations Board ruled that football players at Northwestern University should be considered employees and given the right to form a union. Jeff, depending on who you read in terms of reaction to this, this is either no big deal or a very big deal. First, I think we should point out that it was just the regional office of the NLRB, and the very next step for Northwestern would be to go to the national office of the NLRB. What happens there, and where do we go from there?
Right. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is really the first of many, many steps before this possibly gets resolved. So at this point, Northwestern's appeal of that regional director, regional office's decision will go to, as you said, the national office. There's actually a specific division in Washington, the Office of Representational Appeals, which will look into the matter and make a recommendation. But ultimately, it's going to be decided by the five-member board, the National Labor Relations Board, which is made up of political appointees, three of whom are Democrats, two of whom are Republicans. Of course, you can never predict these things with absolute certainty. I think there's a pretty good chance, for reasons, frankly, that aren't necessarily related to athletics, that they will approve this decision. It could go the other way, but I do think that there's more of a likelihood than not that they'll approve this decision. Where it's going to get interesting, though, is after that point, where if Northwestern loses, they could appeal to a federal court of appeals. There's two likely choices. One would be the D.C. Circuit, which is located in Washington. The other is the Seventh Circuit, which is located in Chicago. My guess is they'll go to the Seventh Circuit because that still has a Republican majority. And those judges, depending on the panel or if the entire court ends up hearing it, are generally speaking no friends of the NLRB or unions. So I think there's a decent chance that they might flip it. Now, of course, I should note that a lot of people aren't fans of the NCAA either, so it may be who you dislike the most ultimately coming out. And then if after the Court of Appeals decides, it could, if they choose, ultimately go to the Supreme Court, and all bets are off on that.
Well, now, there are two caveats to this whole thing. Number one, the players haven't even decided yet if they want to be represented by a union, so that would be step number one. And even if all this goes through, the NLRB would represent athletes at only, or the union would represent athletes only at private schools, not at public schools.
That's absolutely, both of those are absolutely right. So the NLRB could get involved now before the election is set. And I think I just heard this morning it's the region set it for April 28th. So the board could either delay it and consider this decision or ultimately flip it and then suspend the election. If they don't and the election's held, then you're absolutely right. If the players ultimately decide against union representation and the union needs to win over 50% of the votes to get elected, then, right, it's a moot issue. And, of course, they might try it again at another university. So all the appeals that I talked about are dependent on if there is an election, the union actually winning that. And then, as you note, right, that the NLRA only applies to private sector companies, and in this case universities. Some states have public sector labor laws that might interpret or classify players the same. Some of them might do differently. Other states, like North Carolina, do not have any public sector labor laws. So, you know, Coach Cutcliffe may have to worry, but not Coach Fedora.
Well, actually, I think it's Fedora who would worry more, because if, let's take this to its what could be its conclusion, and that private schools, athletes there get to unionize and maybe have Cutcliffe would maybe have a recruiting advantage.
Potentially, and this is where it gets sort of, as you mentioned, right early on, although the scope of the decision itself is narrow. One, it's by just a regional office. Two, it only deals actually with Northwestern. So one other thing I should note is, theoretically, Duke's football program could be treated differently than Northwestern. I think that's unlikely, but the board will typically look at each individual union drive to see whether those players are employees or not. Right, but beyond that, of course, right, there's a sort of ramifications, and we can talk later about maybe other labor and employment laws that might follow suit. Right, but then you have the question about, well, if do certain players on certain teams are unionized, how might that affect other teams that perhaps aren't unionized? And we see this frequently in you know, the private sector and companies. Unions, one of their main goals is to try to organize as much of a certain industry as they can. I mean, sort of the classic example is Detroit auto industry years ago. And so there wasn't a real competitive disadvantage to having union from if you were GM or Ford or Chrysler, because you're all kind of on the same page, right? And you're sort of appropriately flipping that question, which is, well, you might actually have an advantage if you're recruiting players, if you can say, look, we have a union that we're going to deal with. Now, one thing I'll note is, in most places, most states, a public university does not have a barrier to actually either talking with a union, formal union, or talking with employees. When I say that most states don't have, or a lot of states don't have, labor laws that sort of reflect the NLRB, what that means is an employer, in this case the university, doesn't have a legal duty to negotiate with a union.
All right, we'll come back on Sports Focus right after this.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now, back to the show on 97.9 FM, WCHL.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. Today, we're talking about the possible unionization of college athletes. Our guest is Jeffrey Michael Hirsch from the UNC School of Law. Jeffrey, we talked about possible competitive advantages for one school over another. One of the issues that also arises is you're talking about very different groups of athletes, even on the same campus. You have football players and primarily men's basketball players who are in the revenue sports. You have plenty of other athletes who are in the non-revenue sports. Does a union represent all of them? Is there a union for just women's tennis, for just men's lacrosse? It seems that we're in a situation right now that there are many, many more questions than there are answers.
No, you're absolutely right. And in fact, one interesting thing about the NLRB's regional decision was not only did it make clear that it was only applying to football players, it actually only applied to scholarship football players. So the regional director there said, although the walk-on players do the same amount of athletic work, if you will, as the scholarship players, because they don't receive any compensation, right, in the form of scholarship or other types of benefits, or at least any financial compensation, right, they are going to be treated differently, or at least he is not going to decide that. And part of it has to do with the way that a union attempts to represent a group of employees. Typically what the union will do is say, here's a group that I want to represent. In this case, the union was really focused more on the scholarship players because of the compensation issue. That's not to say a union can't later try to represent even walk-ons or, as you said, you know, women's tennis or something like that. But it's going to be a much harder argument to classify, particularly the non-revenue sport athletes, as employees, because some of the monetary issues aren't there. Not impossible, though, right? Because some of the other issues that the regional director focused on, the amount of hours that they work, the fact that they are receiving scholarships, so a scholarship tennis player, for instance, they're going to share those same similarities with the football players. So you very well might go down that road, but it's less clear at this point whether it will.
It seems like this case and other cases that are sort of progressing through the system at the same time all center on, because the former quarterback at Northwestern is saying that pay for play is not part of the deal. I mean, perhaps later on it would be for them or for other institutions, but they say for right now it's not. What for them is the issue is essentially that the grant in aid does not cover all their expenses. So you have several different groups who are arguing this, and you know, perhaps you're opening Pandora's box by you know, going toward the down the union route. But has the NC2A created this problem, and now is perhaps going to have to pay the piper for doing so?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways this is very reflective of what's going on in the private sector throughout the country. I mean, particularly as the union rate has declined over the last few decades, one of the things that you hear from frequent surveys of employees is that one of the things that they're missing or want more of is not necessarily a formal union, although they tend to be, at least in general, supportive of that, but some sort of seat at the table, some type of voice in how the workplace is run, how their working conditions are established. And unions are obviously a good way of going about getting that type of voice, but they're not the only way. And so one of the things that you're seeing in this college athletics issue is this really the same type of issue, and the players clearly feel like that the NAACP in particular, and perhaps some certain schools, although...
Or the NC2A.
NC2A, I'm sorry. That's too many legal fields I've got in my head. that you know, they're less concerned even with their universities. It's more the overall structure of how the rules that govern college athletics are being made, and they clearly don't feel that they have any or at least enough substantial input into how those rules are being established and how they take into account those players' interests. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. Perhaps the NC2A, had they been more open about listening to players' concerns early on, they wouldn't have seen these types of lawsuits, these types of union drives. But the genie may be out of the bottle at this point, so who knows whether they can turn back the clock, even if they wanted to.
Something you said that was very interesting earlier is that there could be, in fact, I think there will be, a political component to this because of the makeup of the various boards.
Yep.
And one person's distrust of unions versus another person's distrust of the NC2A. And what are your students saying about all of this?
Yeah, I mean, they're fascinated by it. I mean, it's obviously they're, you know, a lot of them are just at us. College themselves, so I think they can certainly see from the athlete's perspective. Although obviously being a particularly a revenue sport college athlete is puts you in a different echelon. But they're oftentimes torn. I mean, we talk about in class all the time that classification of workers as either employees that enjoy protection of various laws versus excluded workers. It's oftentimes a highly abused area that employers can frequently get away with classifying people you might consider employees as somebody that's not. So there's, I think at first blush, they tend to be sympathetic to the college athletes' attempt to be classified as employees. That said, right, with sports, everybody's got their own view. So, you know, in some people's minds, I think they would, you know, give their right arm to be a college athlete. And, you know, you have a little bit, just like you have in the professional sports, that sometimes those employees or those athletes aren't always the most sympathetic in the public's eye. So, yeah, it's really mixed, which is what you kind of see in the general public news on this story as well.
Sports Focus will be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Sports Focus and our discussion of the possible unionization of college athletes. We're talking with UNC law professor Jeffrey Michael Hirsch. Jeff, you talked early about you're predicting that the full board would approve this ruling that was made at the regional level. And in fact, William Gould, who teaches at Stanford in law, he was the former chair of the NLRB. He thinks the board in Washington will uphold this. So How quickly do you see things moving on this? And because even if that gets approved, certainly Northwestern will, and the NC2A probably, will appeal.
Yeah, although I stick with my prediction, you can never be totally confident of it. The one thing I do feel confident about predicting is it'll take a while. The NLRB, like any court and other sort of judicatory body, it's not the fastest in the world. It would take, at the minimum, several months, I think, for the board to make a decision on this, maybe even a year or more, although I suspect they might try to go a little faster with this. But then if we're talking about going to court and hearing court challenges, we're talking a couple of years at least from this point in time. So this is not an issue that's going to be resolved anytime soon.
I know you haven't coached sports, but you know, knowing the relationship, if you will, between an employer and an employee and how that relationship might change if that employee becomes part of a union, how can you offer any insight at all as to how the relationship between the coach and the player might change?
Yeah, no, and that's a great question. And generally what you see is some places it works really well, some places it doesn't. You know, oftentimes I think if there's a good working relationship, there's evidence that unions can actually improve productivity, right? You're improving communication channels. Oftentimes the union can act as a filter if employees, or in this case college athletes, have certain grievances or complaints. You know, sometimes a union can even say, look, you're out of line, you need to think more about this. So it can work quite well, but other times it doesn't work well at all, right? Lots of times you'll have an employer, and you can certainly imagine a coach being in this situation, perhaps even more so, really not liking what they view as interference in their domain, because particularly in the private sector, they're going to have to talk with the union when they're making certain decisions about the players' lives, particularly their sort of work-related lives, and that's going to be something that they haven't had to do, and a lot of them are not going to like, and that can cause problems.
I've read one writer's opinion about this, and fascinating to me, he is saying that the right-to-work states, where you would think this has no chance of going through, it's actually a better chance of having some impact on, say, a state like Florida, because public sector is fairly heavily unionized in Florida, even though the state itself is a right-to-work state. Would it be a state-by-state kind of thing that University of Florida could have a competitive advantage over Alabama, even within the public schools?
Well, I think in particular the public schools, as I sort of referenced a little bit earlier, I mean, this is where North Carolina might be at a big disadvantage, because there a public football or public coach could not, in a meaningful way, really negotiate with a union, because there's actually a law against it. There's only a couple of states that do that. So Florida might have a big advantage over, at least for recruiting players, over that. But then you also obviously have a difference in culture, and this is where the sort of right-to-work states might have an impact. Those might be areas where the players don't want to unionize, or even if they do, there might be more resistance to it. It can really be specific, even within geographical regions, as well as, I mean, different workplaces have different cultures. You see that with, non-labor issues on different teams of every stripe. So you're going to see a big variety of things if this goes through.
Who would have thought several months ago that a few players wearing armbands or wristbands with the letters APU, All Players United, would erupt into something like this? That does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Jeffrey Michael Hirsch of the UNC School of Law, for excellent insights into the legal ramifications of possible unionization of athletes. Thanks also to producer Justin Blankenship and engineer Dylan Field. Thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall of the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance, and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a production of UNC's College of Journalism and Mass Communication. Check out our comprehensive community calendar, photo galleries, and all of our news stories and more from 97.9 FM WCHL on chapelboro.com.